Well, good morning. We're so glad you're here. I did hear again somebody else say, go Niners. I see some Niners gear out there. I got my closest colors on this morning. Somebody said that pitchers and catchers report in like 4 days, so baseball is almost upon us, whether you like it or not. If you have a Bible, turn with me to Esther, the book of Esther. Chapter 7 is where we'll be this morning. If you want to keep up with us and what we'll be doing next Sunday, we're going to be in Esther chapter 8, so you can read ahead and read that chapter and just be ready for what we'll be looking at. But we've been going in this series, going through this book, mostly chapter by chapter. A lot of these chapters are very short. If you look ahead to chapter 10, you see it's very, very short. There's so much happening in this. And before we get to Esther 7, stay there because any other verses other than Esther 7 we'll have on the screen usually. But when you look at people in the Bible like Esther and Mordecai, who's a part of this, and you see what they go through, one of the people that really stands out in the Bible for us as we look at them is a guy named Job. And when you look at Job here in the Bible, you can't help but feeling really, really bad for a guy like Job and what Job went through. I mean, Job was a godly man. It says in the Bible that he was a righteous man, and then he had his whole life come crashing down on him. And it came crashing down on him for really no apparent reason other than what appeared to be some kind of joke or even a cosmic joke, really, right? Because it was some sort of satanic cruelty, along with, for some strange reason, it seemed like, why would, you know, God allowed this all to happen? And I think we can handle the first part of that okay, right? The satanic cruelty. We understand how he works, and so that doesn't really, you know, we don't like it, but we can understand how that can happen in our lives. But the other part of that, it's really hard for us to grasp, to understand. How could God allow this to happen? How could he allow something like this to happen? And God wasn't absent. He wasn't uninvolved in what was happening, but he was silent in it. At least he was with Job. And it's this mysterious sense of God's silence in Job's life, which looked like to Job was God's absence, that God had left him, abandoned him. And that was what makes us ask, why? Why would God do this? And Job, he must have felt lost. As he sat in the mess of everything that was once beautiful in his life and where everything is now been taken from him, is gone from him. You know, everything was going well at one point and then all of a sudden nothing. Now his livelihood is gone. His children are all gone from him. Actually, he lost everything except for his wife. And then he gained an ailment, right? He had sores from his head to his toes. Everything happened to him within a course of a couple of days. And he didn't know why any of this happened. And in that pain of having all of this happen in his life, he started to voice his pain. Words just started to come out in the midst of this horrible pain. And these words that were easily criticized by those around him who knew him but who were living comfortable lives of health and ease, they made fun of him, but Job says this, and I'll show you to this on the screen up here. In Job chapter 3, after all this has happened, it says, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, a man is conceived. Why did I not die at birth, come out of the womb, and expire? These right here, these words, are words that you say when you don't know why any of this has happened to you. He feels completely abandoned, and he's actually worse than dead because he's living in the misery of everything that's happened to him. And he goes on in verse 24, And he says, "For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water, for the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes." Now, you can't criticize Job. None of us can unless we've been where he's been, gone through some of the things that he's gone through. Because for Job, this is the worst kind of existence. It's bad enough to have everything gone, but now and then to have your body covered in sores from head to toe. But it was worse because he couldn't hear the voice of God in any of this that was happening in this moment. And as we think of Job here this morning, I also want us to think about time. And yes, we're going to get to Esther chapter 7 in just a few minutes. But as we think of Job, I want us to think about time. And it's our time versus God's time. When we're in the, you know, we're just in this one tiny moment that's called the present. And that's really what we can see right now is what's happening now. We can look back, yes, but we're living in this moment right here, right now. And so our perspective is based on this precise moment, right now, right here. And we can speak about the present. We can speak about the past. We can even speak about the future. But if you want to know, like, what time it is, what do? We look at our watches, we look at our phones, we look at a clock, right? We can find out what time it is. If we want to know what day or year or month is, we look at our phones again, we look at a calendar, we can find out what it is. Time is easily marked. It's carefully measured. It's very objective, right? We know what it is. We can measure it, we can understand it, and it's conscious, so it's there. The thing about God is God is not like that at all. God lives and moves outside of the realm of earthly time. He's beyond the ticking of our clocks and the turning of our calendars. And that's so hard for us to understand that God is outside of time. We can't really put our grasps, you know, we can think about it, I get it, God's outside of time. But really, we have nothing to compare that to because we are in time. And so God's not like that at all. Think about it. God doesn't have night. God doesn't have day. He doesn't have months. He doesn't have years. God doesn't have a past, present, or future. And this is called the transcendence of God. Theologians call that the transcendence of God, that he transcends all of time. He's outside of it. And so we see our lives in sequence of frames moving from one to another. It's kind of like a movie, you know, and it's making sense because it's moving along. That's not how God sees things. He sees the whole movie of our lives all at once. In a flash, along with millions and billions and whatever down the line, all at the same time. He sees them all at the same time, past, present, and future. And we say, you know, we can come to church and we can say, yeah, it'll happen in God's time. But there we have a little bit of a problem. Because with God, there isn't a day. He's not locked into our time frame. Our problem is that we're looking at life the wrong way. We're finite creatures. So when it comes to the way that God sees everything, and his perspective on the things that are happening in our lives and in this world, that he's outside of time, we're just like left scratching our heads thinking, like, what's going on? And so to help you with that, I'm going to read to you a little bit of a quote here from a guy named Philip Yancey. He wrote about this in a book called Disappointment with God. So hang with me. I'm trying to make this as clear as possible if you're like still scratching your head a little bit. But he says, and I'll read this to you, it says, "No matter how we rationalize, God will sometimes seem unfair from the perspective of a person trapped in time. Only at the end of time, after we have attained God's level of viewing, after every evil has been punished or forgiven, every illness healed, and the entire universe restored, only then will fairness reign. Then we will understand what role was played by evil and by the fall and by the natural law in an unfair event like the death of a child. That's the only time he'll understand what he's talking about. He goes on to say, until then, we will not know and can only trust in a God who does know. He says, we remain ignorant of many details, not because God enjoys keeping us in the dark, but because we have not the faculties to absorb so much light, so much information. At a single glance, he says, God knows what the world is about and how history will end, but we, as time-bound creatures, have only the most primitive manner of understanding. We can let time pass. That's the way we understand, he says. And he wraps it up with this. He says, not until history has run its course will we understand how all things work together for good. Faith means believing in advance what will only make sense in reverse. So are you still with me here this morning? All right? Because this is hard stuff that we're talking about here. It's hard, you know, as moving from saying in God's timing here at church this morning, saying, oh yeah, in God's timing, he'll take care of our situation. But then we go out into the very real world of pain and loss and sudden tragedies, and it's a lot harder to say in God's time. So what do we do? What do we do? How do we live in this world without panic? How do we live in this little space of time not knowing where to go always? How do we live when the times that we're in, we just don't hear God's voice in that moment? Or maybe we don't for days or weeks or even longer. We live in this world by discovering how God works, who he is, and by having confidence in him. If you want to know how to go on, you have to know who God is. You have to know how he does things, how he lives, and then we have to have confidence in him. And as we've been looking at this book of Esther, we're finding that it's an incredible book. This book, the only book in the Bible that does not mention the name of God one single time, is such an incredible book. Another interesting thing to note about the book of Esther is that there's not a single verse in the book of Esther quoted in the New Testament. And that's a very strange thing as well. It's easy to be tempted to see everything that's happening here in Esther and say, well, God is really absent. God is not there in this moment. But that is hardly the case. That is not what is happening. God is all over this incredible time in Israel's history. We can see the hand of God all throughout Esther's life and Mordecai's life. We can see him moving in the heart of King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, depending on which translation, because it's the same name. He had just a Greek name and a Persian name. We can even see how he works his own will in the evil, wicked plots of Haman. How? Why? Because this book here of Esther is written from the perspective of God's transcendent presence, of him outside of time. He knows what's going to go on. And so when we read through Esther, we see this sustained time of silence where God does not speak. And we see the king promote this guy Haman up the ladder in his kingdom. And we want to yell, King, don't do that. You're going to be sorry for promoting this guy. He's the bad guy in this whole situation. He hates all of the Jewish people. You better not promote this guy. But the king gets promoted. And Haman climbs pretty much to as high as he can. And then this evil plan of his gets set in motion to kill every single Jew in the whole Persian kingdom. And we want to yell, God, stop it. End this. Don't let this happen. But we don't hear anything. We don't see anything from him. Nothing is happening. And we see Haman, he sends out this decree, right, to have all of the Jews killed in the kingdom of Persia. 1 year from when this decree gets sent out. And then the king's signet ring is seals this decree so that it's going to make it official. It cannot be erased. And we think, God, stop it now. but we don't see anything happen. If we were there in this time period, we'd have been thinking, where is God? What is he doing? We'd have all sorts of questions in these moments. But let me tell you, in these times of silence, God is at work. He may be silent right now, but he is doing something in the midst of that. And if you don't know this, if you don't believe this, if you don't remember this, that when God is silent in your life at different times, you're going to panic, you're going to doubt him, you're going to become cynical about everything, you're going to be resentful, and you're going to be filled with bitterness. We have to know that this is who God is. Even when he is silent at times, he is still at work. And as many as there are of stories in the Bible that you read where God speaks to his people, you think about the story of Moses, right, in the burning bush and beyond. God speaks to him and leads him to take the whole people group out of Egypt in slavery. And then you have the story of even Joseph, how God speaks to him and leads him throughout to, you know, to save their people group through the famine and all of those things. You have the story of Hannah, and she prayed for God to give her a son, and finally God blessed her with a son named that she named Samuel, who became a great prophet. And as much as you see stories like that, there's lots of those kinds of stories throughout the Bible. We also see those stories in the Bible of silence. What about the 400 years of silence from the end of Joseph's life to the beginning of Moses' life? Nothing there. In 1 Samuel, after Hannah prayed for a son, it says in 1 Samuel 3 that, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision. We even think about the prophets and we think, well, the prophets must have heard from God all the time. Well, not always. What about the prophet Habakkuk? He saw all sorts of horrible, unjust things happen, and they happened one after another, after another, after another, just keep piling up. And finally, Habakkuk couldn't take it anymore, and he says, God, why? And then he says, how long is this going to be? What was the problem for Habakkuk? Habakkuk couldn't hear the voice of God. And others could say to Habakkuk, in God's timing. But Habakkuk was lost in this moment because he had not heard the voice of God. And then you have this 400-year time period between Malachi, the last prophet in the Old Testament, to the birth of Jesus, and there was just this 400 years of silence. There isn't a single verse written during those 400 years. That's incredibly hard to go through. And if we want to understand what's happening here, in the book of Esther, but also what happens sometimes in our own lives, we have to understand a couple of things. And the first is, life is filled with times of silence. I went to the second one, so you get the surprise on what the next one is. But the first one is, life is filled with times of silence. And these times of God's silence in our lives, they actually can be as significant for us as the times when God speaks to us. Now, they are definitely more painful, but they are still significant. During these times of silence, you need ears of faith to hear the voice of God. What we need to know is that his surprising sovereignty, where he has all things under his control, that often takes time for it to unfold. It's the way he works. Just takes time. And then you see the second one up there. The turning points in our lives, the big events that happen in our lives, they often start small. They're just a small thing that happens. And so we need to have a sensitive heart to see those changes happening. In Esther 6, the small little change that happened was we saw that the king couldn't sleep one night. That's not really a big deal, right? That doesn't make the headlines in the news. Have you ever seen one? Well, the king didn't sleep last night. That doesn't make it, right? It's not noteworthy. Even here in the book of Esther, it's very understated. Well, the king couldn't sleep. But it had an incredible result. Mordecai is remembered because the king couldn't sleep. He called for the chronicles to come in and read to him the history of his kingdom, hoping it would put him to sleep. And then he is reminded of the story of how Mordecai saved his life. He said, what happened to him? Did we do anything for him? And they said, no. But that little thing leads to the key ingredient to move along God's plan here. In the mystery of God's timing, small things happen that the sensitive heart picks up on. That's why God's wisdom is so important for us. We need His wisdom in our lives. Noticing these things is what Christian maturity is all about. Notice small little changes that happen. Instead of thinking, I'll never make it through this thing that's happening in my life, I'm never going to hear God's voice again. Instead, what we need to do is we need to look in wisdom for the smallest turning of events that are happening in our lives. We see God's about to do something. And then the very next morning, after that night where the king couldn't sleep, who is found in the court? Well, of all people, it's Haman, the one who is trying to kill all of the Jews in the kingdom. 127 provinces in Persia. Haman, who had just built a gallows 75 feet high to impale his enemy Mordecai on, he's in the court. Haman, who thought he was the best person in the kingdom because he'd been promoted to such a high level, he said, I will get my way. The king will listen to me, and Mordecai will be impaled on these gallows very soon, this very day. Wrong. See, the king calls him in, and he wants Haman to help him honor somebody in the kingdom who needs honoring. And Haman, being the guy that he is, says, well, who else would be honored other than me? He's got to be talking about me. And he lists all of these things that he wants to be honored by. Wrong. Why? Because that's not God's plan. God's plan was to honor Mordecai. Haman is the one, then, who has to lead Mordecai all throughout the city, shouting to everybody the praises of Mordecai, the greatness of Mordecai. This was a huge change of events, but it started with that smallest of things. The king couldn't sleep. And it's easy to say, oh, this year is not going to be better than last. It's going to be the same thing. Well, actually, there's a good chance that it will be completely different. And when things begin to change in your life, you have to see that they're not just coincidences that are happening. Nothing is coincidental. We aren't just lucky. In God's time, and only in God's time, He begins to move, and surprisingly, His sovereignty, His control of everything is revealed, how He's working. And we see change happen. And when you see change happen, don't fight it. Don't argue with it. Just go with it. God is working in God's way of showing us Himself in the mess. It's that change. That's His way of showing us who He is and what He's doing. And this only happens and always happens when He is ready. Now, all of this, and we're going to bounce through chapter 7 pretty quickly. Let's get into chapter 7. So if you have your Bibles open, Esther 7, verse 1 and 2 is where we'll start. And as you see, this isn't a very long chapter. So the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, what is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be fulfilled. Now this is the second banquet, if you remember. Esther had invited the king and Haman to a banquet because she had gone and stood before the king, and she wasn't sure if she would live that because You weren't allowed to enter, even as the queen. You weren't even allowed to enter the court of the king unless you were invited. And the only way you would survive that is if the king put the scepter down. And she went in and she stood, and the king put his scepter down and said, "What is it you want?" She said the same things he's saying here in this banquet. And so she said, "I want to invite you to a banquet." Second night, he said, "What?" Or the first banquet, he said, "What do you want?" She said, "Come to another banquet, you and Haman, and I will tell you then." And so this is that second banquet. And this banquet only has Esther, who's the queen, the king, and the enemy of the Jews, Haman. And during this banquet, the king, and he finally just again asks, he says, "Esther, what is it that you want?" This is the second time, or actually this is about the third time he's asked this of her. But Esther wasn't ready to answer that because the timing wasn't right. She understood that it wasn't yet time those other two times to answer him. She had a sensitive heart to God, and she trusted in God and God's timing in all of this. And let me ask you that this morning. Are you sensitive to God's voice? Do you know when to listen? Do you know when to speak up? Because there's a time for both of those things. Do you know when to stay quiet? Do you know when, you know, how much to say? And when to say that very thing? Do you have the wisdom to hold back until the right moment? These are the things that make a difference in our lives. And let me just tell you, nobody is perfect with that. Nobody is. But we have to ask, are we in tune with God and his subtle signals and promptings in our lives? And this is what we're seeing in Esther in this moment here. So she hasn't revealed what's bothering her. The time wasn't right yet. She understood that, but now, here in this moment, she had, you know, she was ready to tell the king what was going on. She hadn't even told him yet that she was a Jew. But now she understood. It's time. Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes, "There's a time to be silent and a time to speak." So far, silence was what was needed, but not now in this moment. Can you imagine what Esther must have been thinking here? She knew that her nation, her people group, her future of all of that, hers and her people, hung in the balance of the words that she was about to say to the king, her husband. But it's now when she speaks. Look at verse 3. "Then Queen Esther answered, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. And if we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king.'" Now, these words she speaks here, these are incredible words here. She's like, you know what? If my people, you know, my heritage, if we'd just been sold into slaves, I wouldn't have said anything. No big deal. We could handle that. But somebody wants to annihilate me and all of my people group. And Esther, she now has the attention of her husband, the king. In verse 5, it says, "Then King Ahasuerus said to the Queen Esther, 'Who is he and where is he who has dared to do this?'" Now, I'm not sure I would have been as reserved as Esther is here in this moment. I'd be like, "What do you mean, who is he? What do you mean, where is he? You were there, king, when Haman came up with this idea. You gave him your signet ring, which put a seal on that meant that this was to be put into as an edict that could not be changed. What do you mean, who is he?" That would have been me, probably. But that's not what we see from Esther. But when you think about it, we live in a world where people are so preoccupied. You think about that day when the king was a part of this plan to wipe out one nation group. We have no idea how many edicts he signed that day. We have no idea how full of a plate he had to deal with the concernings of his giant kingdom. And here comes Haman that day, the guy who he trusted more than anybody else. And Haman comes and he proposes this whole thing in such a way that seems like it's solving a problem that affected his kingdom. And the king probably signed this thing without putting too much attention or thought into it because this is the guy he trusted. Haman had to know what he was doing. But now things are going to change. And you can't convince me that a situation in life is absolutely permanent. You can't convince me of that. God can move in the heart of a king. He can move in an entire nation. He can change the mind of a stubborn mate. He can change the affairs of a community. He can move the directions of the president or the prime minister or a king or a queen, whatever. Really anyone in charge. Nothing is too high. Nothing is too deep for God. He isn't limited by space or time, right? He's outside of it. He's not limited by things that are seen and things that are unseen. He lives outside of all of that. He's all powerful. And when God is ready to move, that's when he moves. And when he moves, be ready, because you will see his work in amazing ways. And it goes on here in verse 6, and it says, "And Esther said, a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen." So she answers the king with the same kind of strength and courage she had when she stood before him, when she risked everything, including her life, when she stood before him in the court. Now Haman, he realizes here that his life is being threatened because he threatened the queen with this edict. Now she's speaking up about it. He didn't know that the queen was a Jew. And this sends him into a horrible, horrible fear. Everything now that had been going so well for him is now falling apart. I mean, you think about his last few hours. He had to take his enemy, the one he hated the most, Mordecai, and lead him through the capital city of Susa, shouting the praises of Mordecai. And now, as soon as he goes home from that, right, he goes home to complain to his wife and his friends, and they say one thing to him, and the officials come and get him and take him to this banquet. And here the queen is accusing him right in front of the king. He's terrified, and he should be terrified. And this as we see this, and we've been going through this book here, this really makes us happy as we see this because we love justice. We want to see justice done. We want to see good rewarded, and we want to see evil punished. And that's what's happening here in these moments. And the king puts all of this to end really, really quickly. Verse 7, and we'll read down just the last couple of verses of the chapter, and we'll wrap this up here in a few minutes. It says, "And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king says, will he even assault the queen in my presence in my own house? And as the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance of the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king was abated." It escalated quickly. But when Haman had the gallows built, all he could see was Mordecai hanging, being impaled from them. Remember, these aren't like the gallows we think about in the Old West, right? This was just a giant pole. You impaled somebody on it, and you impaled somebody, and you hung them off this giant pole until they died. It's close to crucifixion, like the Romans took their idea of crucifixion from this. They just put nails in your hands. So this is how violent they were back then. And so Haman built this for Mordecai, but now he's being condemned to die on them. And this is God moving in this to save his people from harm. The sovereignty of God, it's not something to be feared, okay? It's not even something to make us just be passive and not do anything. We think, oh, well, if God is sovereign, if God has everything under control, I don't have to do anything because he's going to take care of it. That's not the way God works, as we see here in Esther. God moved Esther to this place for such a time as this to save the people. See, God's sovereignty should actually comfort us. He alone is God, and he does all things well. And when he does things, he really only has good as his goal. That's the way he does things. How much, then, can we just embrace that, right? How do we not embrace that? If God is good, he does things well, then we can trust him. Now, does that mean I can explain the sovereignty of God? No. Only sometimes I can, when I look back with insight after what's happened, you know, what God has done. Does that mean I always anticipate God's sovereignty in my life? Again, no. There are many times I rush to judgment or I respond in panic, wondering why God is silent. Why are the wrong things still happening? But being able to look back at what has happened, when I let my emotions get in check, I can see what God's about sometimes. I can sometimes see why God delayed in doing what he was doing or why he acted at this time he did. Usually, I think God's too slow. And I'm usually surprised, even though I shouldn't be, at how perfect his timing works out. I find comfort in knowing that God is good and that he will have his way when he pleases, and it will be for his glory. And what could be better than that? That God knows the perfect timing and it will be for his glory, that people will see how great he is. In all of the mystery of his waiting and working and all of the wrong of our doing sometimes, or the undoing that we do or whatever it is, he can still be trusted. We just need to be sensitive to those moments when God breaks the silence and he suddenly intervenes on our behalf in our situation. That's what Esther does here. Now, we live here on earth, and sometimes it seems that God is silent there, and we feel like he's absent, but he's not. He's working. And when God is silent in our lives, how can we be sensitive to God's working? What do we need to do when we struggle with God's silence in our lives, when we're convinced that his silence means his absence? Well, the first thing that we need to know is that when God is silent, he is not absent. He may be silent, but he has not left you, okay? So what can get us through when we go through these moments? When we don't see God or we don't see what he's doing? Well, the first thing is that the silence is not accidental, or is it fatal in your life? Hold on to that. We need that. When it seems that God is absent, listen very carefully for his voice. Some days it will be hard. It'll be hard to trust when you don't know if or when God will show up in your life. See, when you go through that, continue to listen for his voice. Listen with sensitivity, because his message will come to us in various ways. You see, God gave you a mind and he gave you reason. God gave you a unique sensitivity. It's built into your spiritual system or spiritual DNA. And while you wait on God in that silence, what you have to do is you have to walk by faith and not by sight. You got to trust God that he is with you. And you have to get into his word, the Bible. You got to spend time in prayer. You need to accept counsel for people who are mature in their walk with God. And then you wait. You wait. And there are these passages in the Bible that bring us comfort, that bring us insight into our life. And we got to get in there and we got to read them. We got to remember them. We got to quote them. We got to remind ourselves of those things. You have the Holy Spirit in you, follower of Jesus. If you've given your life to Jesus, You've surrendered to him, and he has forgiven you. You have the Holy Spirit in your life who guides you. Listen to him. There are certain people that you know who know God, that you respect. Get alongside them and listen to them. See, tap into those things. Wait and listen with a sensitive ear. Like Esther, don't rush into those big decisions. And another key is don't talk too much. See, believers who are maturing in their faith in Jesus not only respect God's silence, but they also live it as well. Next, the workings of God aren't related to our time frames, but they're related to the crisis that we go through. This is why God doesn't care if that sale ends today. That's the only day you can buy it on sale. It doesn't bother God that this is the first day of school, or that it's noon, or that it's 4:30 in the morning, or it's 8:30 at night. His timing isn't related to the earth's time clock. And so when you wait, you look beyond the present. And the best way to do that is to wait in prayer. Make your life a prayer. Tell God, tell him, even in your pain, even in the, you don't even know how you're going to make it through this situation, just tell him about it. Tell him the hurt of waiting for him. Tell him in your panic. Tell him you feel trapped. Ask him to hurry up if that will help you. See, God can handle all of that. And when you feel this way, ask God to help you see beyond the pain that you're going through and the present moment you're in. Prayer helps when we can't understand what's going on. It helps us when we're struggling with the big decisions that we have to make and when we're working with difficult people. Prayer gives us a calming perspective on the things that are happening in our lives. And then third, the surprises we get are sovereignly designed. See, when we anticipate God to move and we have to trust his justice. And we may not even live to see God's justice or that justice comes about, but it will come. God is a just God, and so we have to trust him. When God feels silent or distant, our great temptation is to either doubt God or to deny he's even at work in our lives. But more often than not, when something looks like it's an absolute end, it's actually, a lot of times, it's the beginning. And we can see this later on down the line when we look back after what's happened in our lives. But think about it this way. Think about the cross of Jesus. When Jesus died on the cross, the Romans applauded. The Jewish officials rejoiced. We finally got rid of that guy who was causing us all of this trouble. It's over, they said. And then 3 days later, he's back. He's alive again. And what seemed like an ending was actually just the beginning. And Esther is a great model for us in all of this, for us to follow. This point here in Israel's history is something for us to remember. But even more than that, our best focus is to look to God himself. He perfectly works. He has things in his control. And amazingly, he changes things. Even in Esther's story, Esther, the queen who was once passive, is suddenly in charge. The king here, who was once duped, now knows the whole story, knows the truth. An enemy who was only moments away from exterminating a whole nation is now gone. And even those horrible gallows that were once built for Mordecai will soon have Haman on them. And so we have to ask ourselves, when will we learn? Because at the precise moment when it will have the greatest impact, God ends his silence and he sovereignly moves in that situation. And when he does it, it's full of surprises. Would you bow your heads this morning? Maybe this morning you're in one of these situations right now. It's a situation full of pain and questions. Maybe you feel like Job, or maybe you feel like Esther and Mordecai here. And God has been silent. And that silence has made you question whether he's even with you. In this moment right now, I want you to go before God. And in prayer, tell him how you feel. You can begin to do that right now, silently, in prayer to God. Maybe right now you are at that moment where it feels like this is the end. God is saying, no, this is just the beginning. And if you're in that pain of a situation where it feels like you don't know how it's going to work out, and feels like God is silent, or he is silent, I want to encourage you to wait and listen. I want to encourage you to read and pray, read the Bible and pray. I want to encourage you to get around somebody who knows Jesus and talk to them and see how God just begins to do little changes in your life. And if you need prayer for any reason here this morning, it doesn't have to be about what we talked about here in this sermon. It could be something else. It could be just, you just need somebody to pray for you. Would you raise your hand here? And we're going to have just people come alongside you and pray for you if you need it. So if you need prayer, will you just raise your hand? There's one over here. If some people can just go and pray. And if there's anybody else, would you just raise your hand? We'll just pray, and we're going to close here in just a moment. Ben will come up and close us here in just a minute.